Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The silence of doctors, nurses, and medics during the physical abuse of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the information provided by physicians and psychologists to determine how much and what kind of mistreatment could be delivered to prisoners during interrogation is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Miles, the author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror, a book based in part on eyewitness accounts of actual victims of prison abuse and more than 35,000 pages of documents, autopsy reports, and medical records. Dr. Miles is a professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School and its Center for Bioethics. He's a recognized expert in medical ethics, human rights, and international healthcare. This interview with Dr. Stephen Miles was recorded in mid-July 2006 from his office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We began when I asked him about his motivation to write a book about the treatment of people who are disarmed and imprisoned.
Well, I've done a lot of work on in prisons overseas and with refugee populations, which include people who have been tortured. And when I saw those pictures from Abu Ghraib, I knew that the docs had been present. And the question was, how come they hadn't blown the whistle on it long before those pictures came out?
What was it in the pictures that caused you to know there were doctors present?
Because physicians and nurses are present in every prison. And if they don't see the abuses themselves, they see the signs of the abuses, and they've been trained to do that. And so the physicians had to be aware that there was physical and mental abuse of these prisoners going on. And the mystery got even deeper when it became clear that these abuses had not just happened at Abu Ghraib, but it happened at a series of prisons across Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay. So one possibility was that the medical system had been protesting, but that the protests had been silenced. And the other possibility was that they'd been going along with it.
Which are the possibilities that you believe, or was it perhaps both?
Well, there were some who protested, although most of the protests came from senior FBI and senior intelligence officials. But unfortunately, I found that the medical profession had been built into the system of abuse and had been willfully complicit in concealing it. This did not come from looking at newspaper accounts or magazine accounts, but this came from 35,000 pages of government investigations, including eyewitness accounts, death certificates, emails from the field, autopsy reports, and so forth.
Who are these physicians that are complicit?
The physicians that are complicit include people who are in the reserves and also career military professionals.
How do they justify their activities with their medical oath to do no harm?
The problem was that the physicians and medical system were looking on themselves as soldiers first, and forgetting that with regard to the treatment of disarmed captives, that their primary, indeed their exclusive responsibility was to the well-being of the prisoners. This was coupled by the fact that the prisons themselves were designed as coercive interrogation centers in violation of the Geneva Accords, as this recent Supreme Court decision has found. And so the physicians bent the Hippocratic Oath to accommodate the coercive interrogation system.
Let's talk about the kind of torture that was involved that you have studied. What went on?
Well, I've seen all forms of torture that are practiced in torturing societies: beatings, kickings, suspending people by their arms, near suffocation, electric shocks, sodomy with batons. chemical burns, fire burns, putting people on hot car motors, keeping people in non-air-conditioned, sun-baked metal containers, the whole gamut of things. The only thing that I have not seen is in some prisons, they've engaged, in other countries, they've engaged in mutilation, such as cutting off fingers, hands, or ears, and I did not see any of that in the U.S. prisons.
It seems like in the history of the human species, torture is not new. It's happened for thousands of years.
Torture goes way, way back, although the medical role in torture is actually relatively recent. It was started in about the 15th century when physicians were brought into the torture room or to see torture people before they were tortured to ascertain two things. First, could the person withstand the proposed program of interrogational torture? And secondly, were they capable of giving the evidence that was being requested of them? Obviously, for example, a blind person could not testify as to what they saw. Midwives were also examined women who were about to be tortured to ascertain that they were not pregnant.
What difference did that make?
From the 15th century through the 18th century, women who were pregnant were not tortured. The system waited until the child had been delivered or there was a miscarriage, and then the interrogational torture was done. Now, what happened was that Western Europe outlawed torture in the 18th century, and then torture of prisoners became a huge issue with World War II, particularly with the abuse of Allied prisoners by the German and Japanese governments. And so out of these, the world community created the Geneva Conventions, which set minimal standards for the medical treatment of prisoners and also said that prisoners could not be subjected to torture or cruel or inhuman or degrading treatment, and indeed could not be subjected to coercive or disadvantageous treatment for failing to answer any question beyond name, rank, and serial number.
Yet those Geneva Accords are not followed.
We announced that we were going to unilaterally suspend them in Afghanistan and Guantanamo, although Iraq was supposed to be Geneva compliant. An army investigation by General Fay found that, in fact, there was a similar system of interrogation that was used throughout the entire three theaters. The Geneva Conventions are not unilaterally revocable. That is, they are a definition of war crimes that a country cannot step out of and say that we're simply not going to follow them. And indeed, one of the really interesting questions these days is whether or not the European human rights community will subpoena or indict senior U.S. officials over the next 1 to 2 years.
Who would you anticipate would be indicted?
Well, the coercive interrogation policy was designed by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and then it was implemented by General Miller at Guantanamo. There was also an undersecretary for intelligence called Stephen Camboni. And I suspect that those will be the principals. It's possible that this would go down to the theater commanders, General Sanchez in Iraq and General McNeil in Afghanistan. The president suspended the Geneva Conventions, which would technically make him liable, although that's not the same thing as ordering the abuses, and I doubt that he would be subpoenaed or indicted.
Can you describe the course of interrogation policy that Donald Rumsfeld prepared?
Right. It's interesting. United States government, as well as the British and Israelis, have conducted around 30 years of research on coercive interrogation, and consisting of more than 200 studies, and found that it did not work. As Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld got prepared to put in his so-called counter-resistance policy, that is, for prisoners who were resisting questioning. The Defense Department told him that course of interrogation did not work, but he went ahead and did it anyway. And what he did was he ordered techniques like nudity, isolation, and the use of barking dogs, which quickly became much more extensive and abusive procedures throughout the system. Indeed, there was a collapse of military command authority over guards who went way farther than that policy. Rumsfeld also ordered a system of medical evaluation of prisoners to see if they could withstand the proposed harsh interrogation, and also medical monitoring during the course of the interrogation. There was a separate set of policies which have not yet been revealed but can be seen in practice, whereby prisoners who actually died of torture were the death certificates of those were not released for months, and in some cases years after the deaths. And what that did was that disabled an entire system of early warning, if you will, that something had gone seriously wrong in the prisons, and the pathologists went along with that system.
The medical evaluation of prisoners to see if they can withstand the torture, how is that done? What are they looking for?
They were looking for a couple things. First off, they were looking for things like emotional and physical vulnerabilities. And also they were looking for places where a prisoner should not be injured, for example. One of the problems has been that the pre-interrogation physical exams were kept separate from the general medical records in most cases, and so those documents are not available for instruction. One of the things, though, that is very clear did happen, since it's referred to in a number of documents, was that the interrogators had access to the medical records and would cull those medical records for insights in how to break the prisoners down. In addition, behavioral scientists also developed a plan of attack to exploit the specific cultural beliefs of Islamic men. These would include programs of sexual humiliation, denial of prayer, not telling people when Ramadan was, forced nudity in front of women, things that were called credit card swipes, whereby a woman guard would run a gloved hand up a prisoner's buttocks to allegedly look for contraband, that kind of thing, all of which are strongly taboo in Islamic culture.
It sounds like from what you're saying that there are detailed records that were being kept and that there would be quite a few files on these activities.
There are a lot of files. In fact, I managed to read about 35,000 pages looking for the medical information. Let me give you an example. There was a guy called Al-Khatami at Guantanamo. The entire interrogation was overseen by a psychologist who went on for about 2 months with very, very, very prolonged sleep deprivation. Then there were a series of humiliating techniques that were applied to him. He was restrained for days and days at a time with very, very occasional breaks in the restraint. In addition to that, he was given IVs. Sometimes he was given IVs and forced to urinate on himself. And then at one point, he was chilled with an air conditioner to the point where his heart slowed down to 35 beats per minute, or his pulse slowed down to 35 beats per minute, and that required hospitalization. He was rewarmed in the hospital for 36 hours. Some blood chemistries, which had become deranged by his treatment, were corrected, and then he was taken by ambulance back to the interrogation room where the interrogation resumed. Doctors, medics, nurses, and a psychologist were present and advising this interrogation all the time it was in progress.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Dr. Stephen H. Miles from his office in Minneapolis, Minnesota, about his book, Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Dr. Stephen Miles, what kind of person imposes the torture? In other words, what state of mind does it take for someone to do these acts to another human being?
There have been studies of people who torture that find no particular psychological or psychiatric profile or no upbringing characteristic. The best way to understand torture is that torture is a social decision, that it begins when a society dehumanizes an enemy. At that point, the society passes special national emergency acts, which take away the ordinary legal protections for this class of persons. Special institutions are then established for these people, and then the practitioners of torture are put in them and sheltered from ordinary judicial and military or police command accountability. So that in order for torture to occur, you have to have the cooperation, the organization of the government, the assent of the legal profession, the assent of medicine, because around 60% of torture victims report seeing a doctor directly involved in their torture in a variety of countries that have been studied. And so the torture is actually a social practice rather than simply a practice of an individual abuser.
So within the social practice, the torturer or the compliant doctor believes they're actually doing a social good?
That's right. Healthcare practitioners conceive of themselves as part of the overall mobilization of the society against the enemy. And so they participate in that. What's so ironic here is that torture does not produce good information. In fact, one fellow that we took to Egypt and then we tortured, he became the source of the bad information or incorrect information that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda were cooperating on bioweapons. And that was part of the State of the Union address and taken to the UN to secure the resolutions that took us into Iraq. I was recently talking to a Marine intelligence analyst who served in Iraq from 2003 to 2005, and he told me that we were endangering our soldiers as we were sending them out on these wild goose chases to chase down bad information obtained by torture.
You write in your book, Oath Betrayed, that Americans are fascinated with the images of torture, almost to a voyeuristic extent.
I think that's correct. And in fact, I think that our voyeurism has led us to misunderstand what torture is. First off, shows like 24, for example, give us an impression that torture produces just-in-time intelligence that is used to prevent ticking time bombs. I'm unable to prove that that's happened. I've looked at every instance where that's claimed in the Iraq War, and all of those instances are not what they are claimed to be. Torture completely prevents a torturing society from recruiting informants of those whose it's tortured. And it also enrages the population that is directed against. And for example, in Iraq, after the Abu Ghraib pictures came out, the percentage of Iraqis who approved of the American presence dropped from around 70% to around 25%, thereby destroying our ability to broker a civil society in Iraq. The other interesting effect of torture is that when we do torture, we destroy our ability to appeal to the Geneva Conventions on behalf of our own POWs or dissidents in other cultures. And the media presentations that we see of torture show it as a highly effective technique that saves lives, whereas in fact the reality of torture is that it destroys civil societies and it destroys protections that we've used on behalf of our own soldiers and on behalf of imprisoned dissidents who are fighting for democracy in other countries like China.
Notwithstanding the Americans' fascination with torture, Americans object to the public depictions of torture. How do you explain that contradiction?
Well, I think it's interesting that as our movies and TV shows and even cartoons have become increasingly graphic in depicting torture, at the same time there's been this coyness about showing the real images of what torture is. There's a vast photographic collection of what torture is, and even the Abu Ghraib pictures were censored to the extent that we don't show the sexual humiliation of Iraqi women. We've not shown pictures of the children who are in these prisons as well. Interestingly enough, they'll even show pictures of the bodies of Iraq prisoners who've been beaten to death, and their faces. We will not show the buttocks or genitals of these prisoners. And so there's this peculiar inversion between fictional torture, which is becoming increasingly graphic, and news torture, which is increasingly coy. And I think that's led us to a sense that what America practices is torture light, for example.
Well, why or what is the justification for this inversion, the refusal to show what actually happened? It seems to me it's parallel to refusing to show the coffins of people who come back dead from the war.
I think in some respect it does sanitize the process, but also in a larger sense, Americans simply do not understand how destructive torture is in the world. Around 130 countries practice torture today. And in most of these instances, what torture has done is not to secure information, but to prevent the emergence of civil society. That is, it's directed against intellectuals, journalists, teachers, labor organizers, and so forth, and it's used to terrorize a population to try and suppress political activity. Americans tend to view torture as a way of securing reliable intelligence, but the reality of torture is that torture basically prevents the emergence of the kind of societies that we want to see emerge in the world, those with free speech, those with independent political organizations that can hold fascist dictatorships in check.
So in other words, it's the status quo, the groups that have the power and the control the policy that impose the torture.
That's absolutely correct. And there has been a substantial argument that the extreme mobilization of the United States using a war metaphor for the war against terrorism has been the wrong metaphor, that in fact terrorism, including the events in New York and Washington and Madrid, and Egypt and Bali, for example, these are terrible crimes. I won't dispute that. But they seem to me to be the kinds of things that lend themselves better to an international criminal policing system rather than to a war metaphor. Indeed, the use of the war metaphor, particularly as it took us into Iraq, has served as a huge recruiting and training field for terrorist groups. Senior military officials now are referring to Abu Ghraib as Jihad University.
Staying with the concept of torture and bringing it to the United States, the July 20th, 2006 New York Times has a story about torture that was allegedly used in Chicago in the 1970s and 1980s, yet they also say in the same article that the statute of limitations pursuant to which those who impose the torture has passed, and therefore there will be no prosecutions.
Correct, although it's important to note that the Geneva Conventions pertain to internationalized conflicts. They do not apply to domestic institutions. But by and large, many countries have a problem with police forces that abuse their own nationals, and this has been a large issue for human rights groups around the world.
Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror, now that we have seen the problem, how do we deal with it?
I think that the issue for us now is not so much uncovering additional facts in the way that I'm doing it, but rather the question of how do we turn this data into reform. There are several items on the agenda. First, we need to have a massive declassification of documents, including the interrogation logs, which show how these things were constructed. Second, we need to have an independent prosecutor with subpoena power. The existing investigations have been conducted by the military using two-star generals, and one of the consequences of that is that it limits the command accountability to one-star generals, such as Janice Karpinski. The third issue that we're going to have is something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, one in which we as a society can take a look at this history, take a look at the Geneva Conventions, and ask ourselves very seriously whether we wish to be in a world without international law pertaining to the treatment of disarmed captives. Personally, I think that's a very dangerous world. I think that we need to have standards that we can appeal to when Uzbekistan imprisons and tortures its labor organizers. And finally, I think we're going to have probably through European groups, accountability for some of the officials who are architects of our own system.
Well, Dr. Stephen H. Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
About a month ago I read Bury the Chains, Prophets and Rebels in the Fight to Free an Empire's Slaves by Adam Hochschild, H-O-C-H-S Child. And it is an astounding book about how over a period of about 40 years, this small group of people in England got England to abolish slavery at enormous economic cost to England. And it is the most amazing story of human rights that I've never heard of, that I've read about and never heard of before. It is truly worth a read.
Dr. Stephen H. Miles, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
This interview with Dr. Stephen Miles, the author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror, was recorded in mid-July 2006. The book he recommends is Bury the Chains, Prophets and Rebels in the Fight to Free an Empire's Slaves by Adam Hochschild. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.